House Judiciary Committee for Thursday, May 31st, 2007. We're going to go to the Senate Bill 248 first, and then the work session on Senate Bill 1042, and then move through the remainder of the agenda. Because of a notice issue, we won't be able to take up Senate Bill 438 until returning for an afternoon session committee, and thank you for your indulgence on that.
What time?
But we will try to get through all this work here today, because this is our last day to do it. So I will now open a work session on Senate Bill 248A. Council Kalmanson, update us on where we are in this bill.
It's in his pocket.
Red light.
$20
a pizza fund.
$20 a pizza fund. That's my one time during the session.
Oh, the last day.
Yeah. So thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 248 is the non-competition bill, non-competition agreement bill. Before the committee are the A6s and the A7s. Just to remind the committee of where we are with these versions. So we sort of veered off a little bit from the original bill, which dealt with layoffs, and this defines sort of the scope of when these agreements can and cannot apply. There are different components to this bill. One is a notice provision. If you go off the A6s, the 248A6 states that a written arbitration agreement and a written non-competition agreement have to be provided to an employee in writing at the time of the initial offer of employment at least 2 weeks before the employment is to begin. So that would be a condition of, otherwise the non-competition or arbitration agreement would be voidable. Or the arbitration agreement or non-competition agreement has to be entered into upon a subsequent bona fide advancement of the employee by the employer. That's the notice provisions. The second part of the A6s talks about which types of employees that these non-competition agreements can apply to. There is certain conditions that have to apply. First, the non-competition, the employee has to be a person described in ORS 653.020 sub 3, which deals with really managerial type employees. It would take out hourly employees from their reach, so they'd have to be getting a salary. They would also, the salary would have to be of a certain level. If you look at line 26 on page 2, it says the total amount of the employee's annual gross salary calculated on an annual basis at the time of the employee's termination must exceed the median family income for a four-person family as determined by the Census Bureau. I think we heard testimony the other day that that's around $66,000 right now. So that would be a condition that before the non-competition agreement would be valid. Another condition would be that there is a protectable interest that the employer has, and that's defined in the bill. The definition of protectable interest is found on page 2, lines 18 through 25, and it refers to trade secrets or competitively sensitive confidential business or professional information that otherwise would not qualify as a trade secret, including product development plans, product launch plans, marketing strategy, or sales plans. So that's the definition of the protectable interest. The main difference between the A6 and the A7s is there's another carve-out of what is a protectable interest. So if you go to the A7s and you look at page 2, lines 26 through page 3, line 3, that's the primary difference between the A6s and A7s. And so in the A7s it says, adding to the definition of protectable interest, is employed as an on-air talent by an employer in the business of broadcasting, and in the year preceding the termination of the employee's employment, the employer expended resources equal to or exceeding 10% of the employee's annual salary to develop, improve, train, or publicly promote the employee. For the purpose of this subparagraph, the resources expended by the employer to publicly employ the employee must have been expended on media that the employer does not own or control. So that would be the A7s, that would be an additional type of employee that could be covered by non-competition agreements. Other than that, I should also point out that non-competition agreements may not exceed 2 years. There is an error in the A6s and the A7s that needs to be corrected. And I'll just briefly to explain what that is. It was not the intent, my understanding of the, it was not the intent of the work group for this 2-year limitation to apply to anything other than non-competition agreements. The way this is drafted, it can be argued that the 2-year limitation would apply to other types of agreements, such as agreements not to solicit employees or bonus restriction agreements. And so what needs to be added to this bill is, if you look at line 13 at the A6s, it says subsection 1 of this section does not apply to. That needs to say subsection 1 and 2, because 2 is the 2-year restriction. And the same is on line 5.
I'm sorry, Council, that's on line 14 of page 3 of the A7s.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let's go to the A7s. So if we're at the A7s, it would be line 14 on page 3 and line 22 of page 3, where it says subsection 1. It would, should say, unless I hear objection from anybody who is in the work group, subsection 1 and subsection 2. And the reason that is because subsection 2, when it says subsection 1 does not apply, it's sort of carving out from the bill's reach different types of agreements that all these restrictions wouldn't apply to. One of the restrictions is this 2-year limitation. And so it was not the intent for the 2-year limitation to apply to other types of agreements, such as non-solicitation agreements, bonus restriction agreements. And so that's why we have to add the sub 2, because the sub 2 is the 2-year restriction. So if the committee so desires to adopt that, you could either do a conceptual amendment, or I've spoken with Legislative Council's office, and they said we can, if we send it down to them by 9:30, they could get it back by 2:30, and we could pass it out that way, and that would be their preference to do it that way.
So let me get the precise words here, looking at the A7 amendments.
Okay.
So on line, page 3, line 14,
right,
subsection would become subsections.
Right.
And then after paren 1, close paren, we would insert and paren 2, close paren.
Right.
Of this section, and then applies would be changed to apply.
Apply.
Okay. And then is it line 22?
Correct.
Would be the other place, and
yeah,
the same changes made there. And two.
So it would be subsections 1 and 2 of the section.
Do not apply to. And are those the only places that those?
I believe so. And so again, so that what that would do is say that these other types of agreements could apply for longer than 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the last thing I should bring to your attention is if we stay with the A7s and you start at page 3, line 30, and go on to page 4, down to line 9, it talks about situations where even if your non-competition agreement might otherwise be voidable, an employer could pay compensation equal to at least 50% of the employee's annual gross base salary and still have the non-competition agreement be in effect, or 50% of the median family income, whatever is greater. So, and unless I missed anything that someone needs to put on the record, that is basically the thrust of it. And there's everyone here is to answer questions.
Council, let me make sure I understand that the 50% payment carve-out, does that mean that would override the income level requirement for having a valid, so that you could enter into a non-competition agreement with somebody who is paid less than median family income, four-person family, and then have an enforceable non-compete?
Thank you, Chairman McPherson. Yes, it says, notwithstanding subsection 1B and D of this section, and if you look, 1B is on page 2, line 17. That says the employee is a person described in ORS 63.020, and so that's what limits it to salaried employees and managerial employees and the like. And 1D is on page 3, lines 4 through 9, and that's the gross salary. So to the extent you wouldn't qualify because you didn't fall within the scope of 1B or 1D, as long as you pay 50% or of the income or 50% of the median family income, whichever is larger, then that you could still enforce the non-competition agreement.
Okay. As long as you had a protectable interest.
As long as, but you would still need to have a protectable interest.
Okay. Any questions for counsel? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Counsel, the first part, I'm just looking at the A6s. The first part deals with the enforceability of an arbitration agreement. And then the second part deals with the non-competition agreement. And it, just a sort of a drafting thing, in the arbitration, it says the court, and they changed the court to a court. In the arbitration part, it says the court. And then when you turn the page to page two, it says a court. That's just a drafting concern. My question is, when in the non-competition agreement section on in section two on page two, when it says non-competition agreement is voidable and may not be enforced by a court, can it be enforced in arbitration? Because what we've done is we've set up that there's arbitration and it's enforceable in certain circumstances, but then we've said that the non-competition is voidable and may not be enforced by a court.
Thank you, Representative Bonamici. I would say the answer is no to that question. I don't know if Commissioner Gardner has a different interpretation, but the intent certainly is that they're unenforceable, so whether arbitration or in a court of law. So I don't think you have to say arbitration. I think if it's unenforceable, it's unenforceable.
And this is a little out of my area, but isn't it that an arbitration award, ultimately, it's the court that enforces an arbitration award? That you have to, I mean, you get a the arbitration award, then produces a judgment that then you, a court then enters without having to go through a trial, that then is enforced as a judgment.
That's correct. And unless there's anyone who has a different interpretation, there's many lawyers in the audience, but I would say my reading is that it would apply to both arbitration and courts. Okay. Seeing nobody shaking their head.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And counsel, referring to the Hershner-Hunter letter that had concerns about Section 6 of the gross version of the bill, did the concerns expressed on page 2 of their letter, that paragraph starting to address the Section 6 questions, get addressed, or do we know?
I did read that letter. I don't seem to have it in front of me. Is that where they say they're confused about the notwithstanding section part of the bill?
Voids an otherwise enforceable non-competition agreement if the employee is laid off by the employer for any reason other than just cause. Same section contains an exception to the void on layoff rule to the extent the non-competition covenant prohibits the solicitation or transaction of business with the employer's customers.
There is, thank you, Representative Flores, there is an express carve-out in the bill for covenants not to solicit employees of the employer or to solicit or transact business with customers of the employer. And that's on the, if you look at the A7s, that is on page 3, lines 25 and 26. And then, so there would be sort of two ways for an employer right now to sort of go about protecting that type of information. One is a covenant not to solicit, and that's expressly carved out from this bill. A second way is to sort of fall within this protectable interest definition, which includes sensitive, confidential business or professional information. So it was, I did read the letter. It was my interpretation of the bill that it does cover what their concern is. So.
The most significant change in the A7 amendments from what had been presented to us before committee was the addition of material on broadcast on-air talent, and I wonder if it would be helpful to have a presentation for the committee to hear the thinking that produced that. Mr. Fiscom, you or others with you want to describe that feature?
Chair, committee members, good morning. For the record, Dave Fiscom here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters and our 200-member, roughly, radio and television stations throughout the state. I think I'm honored to be here at what I perceive to be your last day of hearings. With me to my left is Don Monahan, the legal counsel for the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, and to my right is Bill Johnstone, who runs the OAB. We thought it was important for us to be here today in case you had questions about what's being proposed in the A7s. I should add, just by way of quick background, we are in a way sorry to be here today because we were fine with the original form of the bill and the changes made in what were at one point the Dash A4 amendments, which have now become the Dash A6 amendments, caused a problem for us relative to our use of non-competes. And non-competes are important part of the method by which our stations manage their enterprises. Thus the reference by your chair to the section that's been added relative to broadcasters. The protectable interest issue is an attempt to deal with the reality that what we're trying to protect is the often substantial investment that our stations make, especially in on-air talent, to promote those individuals, obviously for ratings. There are benefits both for the individuals involved as well as for the radio or TV stations involved. And the effect, perhaps unintentional, I believe unintentional, of the first A4, now A6 amendments would have been effectively to remove the ability, except perhaps in the Portland market, for us to use non-competes in such markets that my colleagues can describe better than I, in places like Bend, Eugene, Klamath Falls, and Medford, multiple station outlets in those communities that would have been, our use of non-competes would have been impeded by, if not prevented by, the amendments. Thus, what we set about was several hours worth of discussion that produced the result which we settled for, we support today, that's before you in the Dash A7s. We'd be pleased to discuss some of the details with you with regard to that, to the extent, especially Mr. Chair and committee members, you have questions about how all this works and why this is important to the broadcast industry. Do these amendments work for us? I think the answer is yes. Our preference would have been the original bill, but so be it. We're at this stage of the process, and we will settle for the Dash 7 amendments and would advocate them to you and encourage you to adopt these into the bill to allow us to continue to use non-competes, especially in the areas as described. I'd be remiss if I didn't express our appreciation officially before you have questions to Dan Gardner and his staff for on the fly in the last 48 hours working with us on this language. He and his colleagues have been very responsive to us. We appreciate that. Mr. Chair, your tolerance to allow us to do this in the waning hours of your committee history is important, and I should compliment your staff. Mr. Kalmanson has been very tolerant of being interrupted in every other activity he's been engaged in recent hours to consider these amendments. With that, we'd be happy to answer questions. This is a very important principle to us. It's why we're here today. The use of non-competes is critical, and it varies for us in the biggest market in Oregon, Portland, which I believe is about 23rd in the country in terms of market size. But there are the other markets I've mentioned are absolutely critical to us as well to preserve our ability to preserve, I guess what you'd say, in terms of this bill, the protectable interest of the investments we make in on-air talent. Mr. Chair, I'd be pleased, and my colleagues can answer questions better than I about how all this works in the state, and we'd be pleased to respond in any way you choose.
Thank you, Mr. Fiskum. Committee, I would direct you to the A7's bottom of page 2, lines 26, starting there, and then over to line 3 of the next page. And the key elements here are that we've identified this amendment identifies a protectable interest in on-air talent in the business of broadcasting, and then there's a condition that in the year preceding termination, the employer have spent at least 10% of the salary level paid to the broadcaster on promoting the broadcaster. So the idea is that there's an investment being made by the broadcast organization in that on-air talent, and that they shouldn't, that broadcasters shouldn't be able to just take that presentation to the marketplace down the street to the competing station and present it there after having had that benefited from that investment. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Fiskum can expand on it. I'm understand that principle, but I'm looking at the last line there on page 4, line 2 and 3, and it says that expended on media that the owner does not own or control. So if we go into a radio personality and I own a radio station and I spend a tremendous amount of resources in that radio station that somebody else would have to buy, that doesn't count towards the investment in developing a radio personality in a small market. Can you talk about the opportunities that might be there to even purchase outside media that one doesn't own or control? How does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I'll just make a quick comment, and then with your indulgence, Mr. Chair, I've encouraged the Commissioner to join. This has been one of the issues that was the subject of some discussion over the last hours. What you see before you is, in fact, a compromise. The Commissioner can speak to the reason the language was there in the first place. That percentage changed in negotiations with the Commissioner over the last hours. I'll be honest with you and say that the percentage went down from 25 to 10, thus making it something that we could live with, but that's a source of concern because it's unusual that broadcast outlets would buy advertising on another station to promote their own on-air talent. So the problem there was one that we dealt with, and we settled on this language, and I'll allow my colleagues to respond more affirmatively to your question, Representative.
Go ahead. Yeah, Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron.
Identify yourself.
Oh, sorry, Bill Johnstone, President of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. And that particular part, again, as Mr. Fiskum identified, we accept that. We don't totally agree with it, but we do accept that. I believe the premise was that the airtime that each station would use on their own station or would perhaps purchase or use on other owned properties within their own company perhaps would be of less value than if they were to go out of town or to a billboard company or to the newspaper or something like that and purchase time. In reality, stations, television stations and radio stations both, in fact, dedicate a percentage of their saleable commercial airtime, radio and television, to self-promote their own properties, their own personalities, and their own to the benefit of those employees on their stations. It may be a percentage of airtime, it may be a number of announcements of airtime per hour. So the time that is used on those properties, a television station or radio station that is used for self-promotion of their personalities, on-air talent, is in fact saleable airtime that they have chosen to not sell, but rather to use for the promotion of their own on-air talents.
Go ahead. Well, actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, if I could, Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. There's a couple of points to remember here. I mean, one is when you're promoting, in an advertisement either on radio or television, and if you picture it, it's Channel 12 News at noon with these three people. Are you promoting the station? Are you promoting the individual? How do you divide that up? Plus, we're trying to set up a statutory construction that fits all parts of the state. One thing to remember is that if you have no one willing to buy that time, it has no value. And where in a heavy, saturated market like Portland, you probably could easily sell that time. Perhaps in a radio station in Lakeview or elsewhere, you have more time than you could possibly sell. And we're trying to fit a rule that fits every part of the state, every media market, and this was the compromise that was come up with.
Follow up, if I may. And I guess, Mr. Johnston, thank you, and Commissioner, thank you. I'm wondering, what are those other resources, though? Because if I'm in Lakeview, and I would say that, you know, where am I going to spend 10% of a guy's $50,000 a year or $60,000 a year salary or whatever that disc jockey's making?
Okay. Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, in Lakeview, they wish they were making $50,000 a year. The owner of the station wishes he was making $50,000 a year.
And he probably doesn't have a non-compete.
As far as the cross-promotion on those stations, there probably would not be a great deal in Lakeview. In Medford, newspaper, one radio station would in fact use another television station to promote their on-air, their morning team or their afternoon drive time. By the same token, the television station would use other radio stations. Obviously they wouldn't use, or newspaper, they wouldn't be using their competitor's television or their competitor's radio station. Again, our only disagreement with this would be, actually in our case, the only disagreement with this would be in the Eugene market, where radio, there is a television station and one television station and six radio stations owned by the same operator. That would really be the only part of that we would disagree with.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, if I could, in the discussions we had, what we talked about was what there actually is in an investment. Oftentimes, particularly if you take the television personalities for an example, you may put in articles in a newspaper, you'll see billboards, you'll see the back of buses with those types of promotions. There's also discussions I had with the industry that they do help with speech coaching, and I'll mispronounce this no matter how I try, but coiffuring?
Haircuts.
It's basically a French term for a haircut. Being a supercuts kind of guy, it took me a little time to get around this. But they, those are the type of investments we talked about they put into these on-air personalities. In some cases, they even provide clothing and makeup. Those all would be counted basically within what we're talking about here. So the concept is, if you put a considerable investment into that on-air personality, then it makes sense. If you don't put an investment into that on-air personality, other than maybe on a radio station where you run an ad at midnight with the person's name on it, then perhaps they should be allowed to go to the radio station down the street or wherever. If you do put an investment, you have a protectable interest.
Thank you. Any further questions for anybody on this panel?
Mr. Chair, could I make a just final comment when you're ready?
Go ahead, Mr. Skim.
Quick question for your staff or for yourself or anybody who wants to answer it. As a non-attorney, I would raise the question, and there may be an easy answer to this, as to whether on page 3, line 3, the word "and," is that the proper use of the word "and," or should it be "or"? And I didn't identify that question in time to raise it before I sat here at this witness table, and so I would leave that with you, depending on statutory construction.
Well, I think it should be an "and," page 3, and it's the A7s, page
right.
3, line 3. It's a series of A through D, and each one of those elements has to be in place before there would be an enforceable non-competition agreement. If it were "or," then it wouldn't work, because you'd have, for example, a person either being exempt under a certain provision of the wage and hour rules, which is B, would be an alternative to the protectable interest standard. So I think it has to be "and." I think you have to have all those elements in place before it's enforceable.
Mr. Chair, I understand that. I was just wanting to make sure that the broadcast industry, and I think I see it, wouldn't be subject to big C on page 2 as well as then small d on page 4, because small d on page 4 was what caused us difficulty in terms of the salary level. The small d on page 3. So, again, I raise it, and it's not an issue. I mean to throw a monkey wrench into this process. So,
well,
your answer is helpful.
Okay,
I would read that you would be subject.
Would be subject to the income requirement. Yeah.
Well, that's not what we agreed.
No, that is a drafting problem, Mr. Chair, because we did agree to not make it subject to the salary test with meeting those conditions. So it is a drafting.
Okay, well, then that's
problem
that is
just
not
for the carve out of on-air personalities.
If Mr. Chair, if we're carving out on-air personalities, the issue that we need to be carved out from, pardon my phraseology, is small d, line 4, et cetera, on page 3, which is the imposition of a salary level, which created problems for us, as that would have been implemented around this state because it would have had the effect of preventing our use in the broadcast industry of non-competes in communities such as I mentioned outside of Portland. Thus, big C on page 2 at the bottom is what would be our protectable interest, and if we're subject to the United States Census Bureau formula calculation, we are in jeopardy.
Then there's something that needs to be fixed here. If the agreement is that the income standard is waived for on-air talent, not for other aspects of the statute, then there needs to be a change made in order to make it accomplish that.
Is the agreement though that like B on line 17 wouldn't apply also? Is that right?
Which page, Mr. Kalmanson?
So page 2. So in this, I just want to know if whether sort of big C should just be its own. You know, if you fall within big C, then non-competition agreements don't apply to you, period. And we don't have to worry about little A. Well, I guess we would have to worry about A still, but not
worry
B.
About the limitation of time. Our agreement was just the salary test was the big part that gave the broadcast industry the problem, because while it may fit in a large market, it may not in a smaller market, and therefore they had to fit these special criteria.
What about sub B?
B as on line 22, Mr. Kalmanson, on page 2?
Line 17 on page 2.
Oh, I see. Small B.
So the employee is a person described. So that would be the salary, managerial. If that,
and if that has been employees, that,
right.
would be, mm-hmm. so that would be fine with us because
that
that's
applies
to whom
as well.
They
so
apply.
Everything.
So I think, Mr. Chair, if I can just add a quick comment, just for clarification, if it helps. I think the issue that drove us to need a solution here of the sort we've described is our concern at one hand that line 22 on page 2, big B, et cetera, we at one point toyed with inserting in that string some kind of phraseology dealing with on-air talent, but in part, Mr. Chair, pursuant to a conversation I had with you, that seemed to be awkward, and so with that in mind, we created big C, line 26 and on, and further then we were trying to avoid the unintended consequence of page 3, lines 4, small d, 4 to 9, that imposed a formula that had the effect, if the calculation currently is in the range of 61,000, that was a problem in our smaller market multiple station areas.
So maybe the way to fix this is to insert something into sub D, sort of carving that section out from people who fall within, I'll have to talk to legislative council, I'm sure that
fall within C,
But that's the only thing that shouldn't apply to the people who fall within sub C, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, it could be something like unless the employee is described in section.
I think it's C. Yeah.
The total amount. Mm-hmm. But we'll let Ledge Council figure out how they want to express it. But that's the idea.
I took a stab at it at the end of. Nation on line 9, something like this subsection does not apply to those who have a protectable interest under C.
Yeah,
that would
works.
Be maybe a more elegant way of doing it. But
yeah.
That would, Mr. Chair, I believe that would reflect the agreement we reached.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, committee, if you have any questions about that agreement or about the broadcasting concept that is being added in these amendments, let's put this to this panel, and then we'll also try to find out if there are any other issues affecting these proposed changes before we, what I would propose to do once we've resolved those would be to bring this back at our afternoon meeting at 2:30 to act on the amendments, make sure it captures what was intended here. Any further questions? Representative Flores, you look perplexed.
Well, only my concern is leaving the conjunction in on line 3, page 3, if you're going to be adding that specific language at the end of small print D, on line three.
No, it has to be an and on page three, line three, because there's a series of A through little a through a little d, and they are a series, each element of which has to be in place. That is, there has to be a certain timing of notice at the when the non-competition agreement is entered into. That's little a. There has to be an employee who is a supervisory or creative kind of person under little b, or and then plus under little c has a protectable interest.
And I understand that, but the conjunction comes after cap c, and it seems to tie it.
That is the and that is between little c and little d. I'm comfortable if that's the way it needs to be.
Right. It's only because the and is there only because it's at the sort of very end of the series within little c. So as long as we have Representative Bonamici's language in there, it should solve the problem. So.
Okay. Are there any more questions about this broadcasting exception or special treatment?
Well, I was just going to make a smart aleck remark. The easy part would be is just not to have the dash sevens and do it. But anyway, I wouldn't go there.
Okay. Any further questions for these gentlemen?
Mr. Chair, for the record, thank you for the chance to reach agreement. Thank you to Commissioner Gardner. And just for the record, as an on-air personality, I don't need coiffure treatments, if that matters.
And I'm still going to Supercuts.
we're going to take that issue of you offline.
All right.
Mr.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who has...
Candidate Edwards has a barber that they can make.
We focused in on the broadcasting element. The other elements of what are now the A7 amendments were discussed in our committee meeting the other day. If you wanted any more input on those, there are people here in the room who are presenting on them, although I don't think there were any changes in those that would need presentation. And I'll throw that out. Is there anyone here who believes that we haven't, that there's something has evolved in the way that the A7s, and I'm looking across the room at some of the key players, and they look like they're fine with it. So then what I'm proposing to do is that we'll close our work session to be reopened then when we reconvene at 2:30 to receive back amendments that have been revised to make the corrections we just discussed. So I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 248 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1042A. Russell Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1042A comes to you from Senator Monis Anderson. You have the dash 12 amendments in front of you. And basically they say that they go back to the original bill, and it says a casino may not be sited in land in an incorporated city unless the electors of the city approve the development. That's basically the heart of the bill. I've asked to have passed out by staff a guidelines that the Oregon State Lottery Commission uses in determining whether a operation is a casino or not. You may know under Oregon constitutional law, casinos are prohibited. Why we have casinos in this state, Indian casinos, is because of the federal Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, which basically says, and it's been a while since I've looked at it, but it basically says if you allow gaming in the state, you cannot prohibit Indian gaming. So that's why we have, quote-unquote, casinos in the state. The issue here is that this would regulate the placing of a casino on land. It's not regulating casino gaming.
Thank you, Council. Senator Bonas Anderson, did you want to present the A12 amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Bonas Anderson that represents Wood Village, Fairview, Troutdale, and Gresham. And as this is very controversial, but the residents were the ones that this bill is very important to. The A12 basically states that if there is going to be a casino sited in a city, that those electors would vote and that they would decide whether a casino would be located. So that's basically what the A12 said. I know the opponents have come forward saying, well, would this affect other establishments that would have gaming? And I think that Mr. Taylor has provided you with the Oregon State Lottery Division retailer contract, and it defines a casino very, if you look on page 3, conclusive evidence that an establishment is not a casino. It's in the middle of the page, number 4. And it lists that the following establishments are not casinos for purposes of this rule. And a commercial establishment with a full on-premises sales license issued by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. An establishment with a limited on-premises sales license issued by Oregon OLCC, where the non-lottery sales are at least 50% of the establishment, and I think that's the key one. So we are able to have our taverns and our restaurants, et cetera, with the gaming.
And yeah. Senator, I think what I should explain for the benefit of the committee, because not everyone was involved in the offline discussion before the beginning of the meeting, a question had been raised about whether the way the bill was drafted, requiring when a facility in which casino games are played, that might impose this vote requirement on just regular lottery establishments. And this is in response to that, because our Constitution forbids, until there's a vote of the people to change it, non-tribal casinos. And this is the distinction that's drawn now that permits that to happen under the existing Oregon Constitution. So with applying that same interpretation to the language of casino as is contained in this bill, it eliminates that issue. If there are any concerns about that, you put the question to...
So the LC or staff made the determination that it does not...
Well, this came from...
OLCC.
I'm sorry.
Because if truly our state would have been out of compliance for years if they didn't have a proper definition of what a casino is.
And while Representative Wisden is reading that, Senator, why don't you comment on the sort of the policy change, or maybe it's a return to the original policy choice that
Well, as you heard in testimony, just to refresh your memory, the League of Oregon Cities posed concerns that other local jurisdictions would have control over land use issues of another local jurisdiction. So to just get rid of that conflict, we're just going back to one local jurisdiction. And so as you recall, Fairview and is adamantly opposed, because this proposed casino would be located right across the street from a very nice, the Fairview Village, which is a very nice subdivision. So they have been adamantly opposed. And so we've had this conflict between two cities, and the league isn't comfortable having other cities determine what another city could do. So that's why we have gone down to the original bill, back to the original bill.
Okay. Representative Barker.
In part of the proposal that's coming up, the attempt to change, even though you can't have casinos in Oregon, so the voters amend and they say, yes, you can. And part two of that is going to say, and it'll be cited in Wood Village.
Yes.
State of Oregon votes and says it's going in Wood Village. Who wins this? People of Wood Village or the people of Oregon? The voters. I mean, it seems like that's going to be a real conflict.
It is. So that's why it's a superseding. By having this initiative, it is superseding a casino in Wood Village. The whole state will determine that. And so we want statute that will at least have the local residents have jurisdiction on determining whether a casino. And if you're concerned about whether what will preempt others, I've also gotten proposed legislation, and there's been numerous cases where the approach of that the legislature does have the authority to adopt statutes that preempt city authority for local control, but then it goes on to say that a city would have jurisdiction in a case like that. And I'm not an attorney and a lawyer, yeah. So if you want copies of what came from...
Maybe I ask counsel, so if the voters of Oregon say we want to put it in Wood Village at the dog track, can Wood Village say no?
So Mr. Members of the committee, if we pass this, there'd be an argument that they could say no, but they determined...
Still have to go to court.
No.
The Supreme Court will decide.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
First of all, you don't need to necessarily come forward, but Ms. Ludwig, does scaling it down to Wood Village alone resolve the issue that the League of Oregon Cities is in?
It's very helpful, thank you.
Okay, for the benefit of the record, Ms. Ludwig says it's very helpful.
Which isn't very helpful.
But I have questions for her.
These local issues that I think give us the most problem. In this
Representative Wisnett has a question, Ms. Ludwig. Could you come forward and identify yourself for the record?
Good morning. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. Thank you.
Question.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Barker, I'm really concerned we're thinking the same thing, because I'm having difficulty with this, too, as far as the people say one thing and the local people say another. You're talking Measure 37 claims and all sorts of things. Are we digging ourselves into a hole here that we don't need to? I'm still concerned that whether we're getting the egg before the chicken or the chicken before the egg here in this situation, because I do support local control. And we heard from the mayors yesterday, and... is the League of Oregon Cities comfortable with this? Has there been other issues that we've gone to the voters and let them decide on a development issue? Are we going to have the voters deciding on all development issues in a city?
Only a casino.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, I would be remiss if I were to give the committee any legal advice upon the bill. I can only repeat what I've said prior, and this amendment takes us back to the base bill. I hadn't seen the amendment before today, but I will tell you that in the Senate committee, when the base bill was being heard, the League did not feel compelled to have to testify in support or opposition of the bill. Our board of directors became concerned when we had adjacent cities voting on what is presumably a land use action or a permitting decision within an adjacent city.
If I were the mayor of the city council, I'd want to have my input of my people on an issue like this, Senator. It's a major issue, so I would want to have them. But to put it in law... And also then, does it relate to just gambling casinos, or does it relate to ball fields? Does it relate to we talked about building racetracks? Is that all going to be referred to the people? And that's what we want to do, fine. But just remember, whatever we vote on here today, we're setting the precedent of saying that the local people have to... The city council elected representations. It's a referral. We're pushing the initiative process again, I guess, at the local level.
Mr. Chair, the mayor came in of Wood Village yesterday and said, "I want this casino there." So why are we voting today?
Because the residents do not want the casino there.
Well, they can take care. Senator, why don't they take care of that with the mayor? Why don't they throw that mayor out and do something? I'm concerned that we're really cracking a wedge open here.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, we are having an initiative put before the voters of Oregon to first of all allow a private casino, which is banned by our Constitution right now, and then a second initiative that will deal with the revenue piece and the siting.
I don't like that either.
And so when we took this to an attorney's opinion, it does say that the proposed legislation is not unconstitutional, and it does not violate state land use law, and I can give you a copy of this. It just imposes an additional requirement on property owners that want to develop casinos. And casinos are very different, and I think I made this statement before, very different than building a Walmart, building a Fred Meyer, building a racetrack, because there are social, quote, ills along with that, and it will change the entire atmosphere. And there are some, and also another thing, our cities are having a real struggle with surviving. Our tax bases are quite low out in East Multnomah County, and we don't have the industrial land, especially in Wood Village, and this is a way for Wood Village to survive. And that is truly a primary motivator for the mayor of Wood Village, because this will definitely help their coffers. But when you have a mayor and some city councilors that want this, that's going to change the dynamics and the culture, the true culture of a community, then this is why the legislature, this is why we are elected, and this is why I'm here. And I'll relate again. This is why we made a decision on Eugene and Springfield and their issues. We have made other decisions also this legislative session regarding the Matolius River Basin, again, looking at issues that the residents truly don't want. So that's why this legislation is before you.
Committee, I mean, it's I mean, if we're going to be drawing out more information that will inform our votes, we should do that. But otherwise, I see Mr. Riggs has come forward, and we could hear from him. We've given some time for people who are advocating on the other side, so it's probably fair for him to have an opportunity to say something. But only let's ask questions if they will inform our decision-making, because at some point we just have to make a decision where we're going to go on this.
Okay.
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I'm not sure who can answer this question. I'm glad to see we got it down to one city. My question is the exemption for tribal casinos. And if in fact we don't want a casino in Wood Village, and I just want to make sure that the laws are already on the books that would set up, because if this private facility that's been a gambling facility for many, many years is stopped for whatever reason, is stopped by the citizens or stopped by the ballot or however it's stopped, with an exemption here, could a tribe go in, purchase the land, and I asked a question yesterday I didn't get an answer to, that's happening up in Washington where they're working to try to get off-site casinos in, I think the reference was to Woodland or someplace up there. Could a tribe later come into Woodland and open a casino there and not, the citizens would not be able to vote based on this exemption? Could you explain that to me?
It's a federal process, and I think the tribes are here that could answer your question better, but they go through an entirely different process. And so, it's been explained to me that in federal law, no, the voters would not be able to vote A or nay. They go through an entirely different process, but I'd rather have the tribes explain that
so
rather than me.
Then they don't need the exemption in here because...
No, they don't.
Why would we need an exemption there if they have to go through a whole different process?
We don't actually need it. It's just a statement to help clarify that is the process. I mean, it just helps clarify for us. But no, we don't need it. I was told that by LC.
That we don't need it?
That we actually don't need that. But I'd like to have it stay in because I want the bill to move today.
Representative Kump.
Just real quickly, Senator, you stated that there is an initiative already drafted in the Secretary of State's office on this?
Mm-hmm. It was actually drafted prior to the 2006 election, and I don't know if you remembered reading about it, but they weren't able to, yes, and we have a copy of it.
Just one follow-up. It's my understanding that the drafters or the proponents of the casino are potentially out-of-state people. Are the names identified? Who is the major investor
No.
in this casino in that process
there
of
are two Lake
disclosure?
Lake Oswego developers, and I think Mr. Riggs could talk to you on that, but we do not know where the bulk of the money is coming from. But yes, there are two Lake Oswego developers that are involved in this.
It is. It's irrelevant.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Senator, we definitely disagree on the Metolius bill. That's in my backyard, and I definitely disagree with that position on that. Are you happy with this amendment, and that will not be changed in the Senate?
Absolutely. I've talked with the chair of the committee that this originated in, and I've told her actually yesterday, and she has agreed to that.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, could I further question, Mr. Riggs?
Hold on.
Okay, committee, we've asked questions of Senator Manas Anderson. But Mr. Riggs, who's come forward, and I'm sure he wants to cover some ground to reiterate his position. We have other people in the room who I'm sure would like to reiterate their position. And so the question is, how much further input from these sources does the committee need?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Thank you very much. I think that all of this discussion continues to inform our vote as we move in that direction, whether or not we move this bill or whether we do not. So I find it very helpful to have as much input as possible.
Okay. Very good. Would you like to hear from Mr. Riggs?
Yes, sir, I would.
And shall we bring, I'm sure there are other people on the other side of this issue who would probably like to bend their ear as well. Do you need to hear from them as well?
If you deem it appropriate, sir.
Okay. Well, Mr. Riggs.
Bend our ear, they want to twist our arm.
I won't twist it too much. The chairman, for the record, Doug Riggs, on behalf of the two in-state investors from Lake Oswego who are the bulk of the financing for this proposal. I do want to clarify that because I think there's been an awful lot of verbiage thrown around about greedy out-of-state investors. The greedy, the out-of-state was used four or five times earlier by one of the witnesses. These are two guys from Oregon, from Lake Oswego, who happen to be in representing McPherson's district, who are the prime backers doing all the legwork and the supporters. And like any major construction project, there will be investors probably from around the country. I mean, the convention center got financing from a variety of places. And when it looks like this process is moving forward and investors are willing to come forward, I think they have a full intent to disclose who their investors are. It's not some nefarious Las Vegas bunch of mafioso bosses. It's two guys from Lake Oswego who have a good idea. Now, whether or not that happens, and this is the second point I wanted to make, goes back to Representative Barker's question, and I handed out a copy of the statutory measure, which says very clearly, the vote of the people to identify the Multnomah Greyhound Club as a site doesn't supersite the bill. It only says it happens. It can happen here, but it can't happen here unless you comply with all the other local land use decisions, which means Wood Village is going to be very involved. As the mayor from Wood Village testified a couple days ago, he fully expects that they'll sign an intergovernmental agreement with the rest of the cities and the county in the area. It's going to have to be transportation systems plans. Multnomah County will have to be involved, so there'll be quite a bit of involvement. I do want to echo Representative Wisnett's point, which is, I'm not quite sure why we would want to tell individual cities that they have to take a vote on a project that they are individually pursuing. It strikes me this sets a very bad precedent for people who don't like particular projects to come in and try to force a vote. And I will tell you what will happen here is that the same group, the Grand Ron, which spent $800,000 or more in the primary election against Governor Kulongoski, will come in and spend that much or more against this ballot measure in a town of 4,000 people. And so I would be much more comfortable leaving the alternative for whether or not the city of Wood Village votes on this issue to the citizens of Wood Village. You know, either the citizens can form a petition and put it on the ballot, or the mayor and the city council can put it on the ballot. And I think this sets a very bad precedent. It certainly is preferable to the original version that came over from the Senate, and I would agree with that. And I'm heartened to hear that the Senate would agree to this language. What I fear is that we'd get to conference, and the conferees would agree to the Senate language, and we'd face the 1042A bill. But I think it sets a very bad precedent for projects that people don't like to come to the legislature and ask you to mandate a vote of the people in a particular city, which in my mind isn't consistent with home rule. They have that option already.
Mr. Riggs, any questions?
And Mr. Chair, just to let you know, I have a copy of the initiatives in front of us, and the second initiative does on page, first page says that it will be located at 944 Northeast 223rd Avenue Wood Village, and then you go to page
section 19.
Oh, no.
One more. There it is.
There, in section 16 or 17, it says casino location, attractive land located in the northeast and northwest one quarters of section 34, southeast, southwest one quarters of section 10. It cites it right in the city of Wood Village, Multnomah County. So it is in. It is in the initiative here.
Mr. Riggs, until you're acknowledged, Ms. Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Monis-Anderson, and is that legal description that you just referenced the current site for the Multnomah Kennel, what was known as the Multnomah Kennel Club? Yes, thank you. And the Multnomah Kennel Club, just to give you a little history, it was a resort destination when it was first built. That was all farmland, sort of like Spirit Mountain is now. Just to let you know the difference.
Representative Flores.
Kind of like Sunnyside and Clackamas Town Center was 40 years ago.
Right. Okay. Any questions for Mr. Riggs or Senator Monis-Anderson?
Just to clarify, I guess, just to understand, we're talking about home rule. So if this bill didn't pass, the citizens by petition, I'm just clarifying this, that just like can put a referendum on, or can the mayor could put it out to a vote in the city. I mean, they're allowed to do that now, correct? A city council could put a decision like this out to a vote.
Generally, land use decisions are within the authority of the city council. They are the legislative body of the city.
And they could choose to put it out to a vote of the people to make the decision. Okay.
Any further questions for anybody there at the witness table? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And any other perspectives that committee members feel they need to receive in order to be fully informed?
I have a question for the council.
Representative Whitman.
Mr. Chair, I still need my answer on the reason for a tribal exemption. I'm not clear on that.
Council.
Chair, members of the committee, there are other people in the room that know this area better than I do. It's been about 10 years since I looked at it. But my understanding is, under federal law, if the state allows gambling, then federal law enables tribes to have casinos in that particular state. We could eliminate casinos in the state if we eliminated all gambling, including the lottery, social gambling, everything else like that. I see some heads nodding up and down, yes. Lawyers Michael Mason represents one of the tribes and is a lawyer and works in this area. That's my understanding of the law. That's why you have Indian casinos. Now, I don't know the issue, that even less so the issue of off-siting. I know there have been attempts to off-site casinos outside of tribal lands, for example, outside of Salem, and I think they had to have the governor's approval, and the governor would not give it. But those are questions best addressed to them.
If you need more detail, we do have Michael Mason, but this bill is not about tribal gaming. It's about non-tribal, but if that's helpful.
No, this bill is about a casino being placed in a particular place, right, and the citizens having the vote. And it didn't, a casino doesn't say private or non-private on the outside, so I want to know if you know, why are we exempting one casino and not another?
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, we can't regulate. It was federal preemption as it relates to Indian casinos. They are considered sovereign nations. Their relationship is, I believe, with the federal government. The federal government and the federal law gives them the authority to have
counsel,
casinos.
I understand that.
Okay.
I understand that we cannot regulate them. But that this is, in fact, a land use issue. That's what we're saying. This is not a casino. This is a land use issue having to do with the casino being put into an incorporated city. Why, in other words, could we have a tribal casino in Wood Village 5 years from now?
I believe it.
And the people would not
be
able to vote on it.
I think it has to be on tribal lands.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Judiciary Committee, Michael Mason is my name. I'm sitting up here because I've been practicing Indian law for 24 years, throughout that time working on land issues, not all of that time working on casino siting issues, so that's part of what I've done for the last several years. And I've also worked in the Department of the Interior on Indian lands issues for 3 years. So to answer, Representative Cameron, to answer your question about siting, it is incredibly difficult to site within a city, to site a tribal casino within a city, and there is a complex, lengthy process for doing that that involves the governor's, involves the Secretary of the Interior's approval, and which he will not grant without the city's okay, and without a determination that it's beneficial to the tribe and not detrimental to the surrounding community, which currently is all the cities and the county within 25 miles, and the neighboring tribes. And then the governor has to agree with that, has to concur before that can happen, the governor of the state. And for taking land, the land would have to go into trust with the United States. To do that, you need an environmental impact statement, which is a 2 to 10 year process, depending on the project. So there is a very detailed, very careful process about this, and it's almost never has happened that this has occurred. And I think it's a critical point on this is to go back and we look at, and I want to clarify, I'm not here supporting the bill for my client, the Warm Springs. We don't have a position on the bill. But our work on the project in Cascade Locks, I think everybody realizes that's been about a 10-year process with at least 2 years to go, I would estimate. And there you clearly have the strong support of the city and the county on that project. So the idea of going to Wood Village, the other limitation there from the Secretary of the Interior is it has to be within the tribe's aboriginal territory. So you have to have a tribe that can come forward and prove that, which is not easy either. And if I may say, without getting in trouble with my client, that would be the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde would be the only tribe in the state that could do that, as I understand it. And that, I'm putting my former federal hat back on for that. But that's, again, they would have to go through this intensive process that would take quite a few years and a lot of local involvement and state involvement.
It's essential to your understanding.
Well, it is, because we can still get there, but are we going to have a vote of the people?
No, I think what we're hearing is that there are a range of obstacles that would prevent a tribal casino from being placed in Wood Village.
Yeah, just like there's a range of obstacles facing a private casino right now today, too. But we're exempting, and we're looking at casinos here, and we're exempting tribal casinos from the vote of the people in a particular situation. And I'm concerned that if the people want to have a say in whether they have a casino or not, it should be a say.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may try to...
I think we've... unless people think we need to go down that path further, I'm fine to not. I think... the question is there more input the committee needs before the decision we have to make on this bill?
I'd like to ask the council.
Okay, question for Mr.
Mr. Taylor. This is a mandate. They must do it. If the, in other words, this doesn't say you know, in 2 and 3, it says you shall submit the question. So we're putting a mandate on the city of Wood Village that they're going to have to go out and do this.
Chairman of the committee, Representative Wisner, looking at the dash 12 amendments, lines 3 and 4, a casino may not be sited on land in an incorporated city unless the electors of the city approve the development. Can't do it while the vote of the people.
It is a mandate from the state requiring that the people of the city vote for the facility.
And it cannot be done unless the people of Oregon vote yes.
Because the Constitution forbids now off-tribal casinos.
You'd have to have three steps. You'd have to have the constitutional provision, amendment to the Constitution approved. You'd have to have the siting initiative approved. And then, if this were to be enacted into law, you'd have to have a vote, affirmative vote, and majority of people voting in Wood Village.
And you've still never confirmed. It'd have to be tested in court who has, does the state override the... If the state says yes, then the people of Wood Village come back.
Well, you'd have two statutory enactments. Mm-hmm. You'd have this statute that says the people of Wood Village have to vote yes, and then you'd have a separate statute that would be the initiative, which would say that is going to be in Wood Village. And I actually don't think those are in conflict. You could say that both things have to be satisfied. It has to be in Wood Village, and the people of Wood Village have to vote for it. I don't see the conflict.
Well, I do, Mr. Chair. I mean, this is the problem we've had when we start getting the state involved in overruling and getting involved in land use and county decisions. This is bad policy.
Any further questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for clarification, the city has the ability to put this issue to a vote of the people currently. Is that correct?
Chairman of the committee, I don't know. We have testimony that yes, that is the case. But have I looked at the law? I have not. Sorry.
Thank you.
At the risk of taking us off in a direction I don't want, if you have a useful point on this issue, Mr. Crane,
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Chris Crane, I'm an associate with Barry Elsner and Hammond. We're a city attorney for the city of Fairview. On the question of preemption, I believe Chair McPherson has it exactly right. The ballot measure would authorize a casino at that site. This bill would add an additional or perhaps final approval criterion. Both things would have to be met. The ballot measure would have to pass authorizing a casino here, and then it would have to achieve an approval by the electors of the city. So both criteria would have to be satisfied in order for the casino to be sited here. There is not, in that sense, a legal conflict. With respect to Representative Flores' question, the city does not, under current law, have authority to prohibit the siting of a casino by a local vote. In fact, I think it's section 20 or 21 of the ballot measure. There's a specific statement that says no local ordinance or resolution may be adopted that would frustrate the purposes of the Casino Act. So the city would not have the authority on its own to adopt something that would prohibit the siting of, that would require a local vote.
It seems to me, Mr. Riggs wants to come back and rebut that statement. I guess the question committee is, how critical is that element in making a decision on this bill with the A-12 amendments?
I want to have an amendment. We'll just move Grand Ronde to Wood Village and solve everything. one swift move here.
Any further information that the committee needs to inform their vote? Well, then, committee, we are in work session, and we have the A-12 amendments before us. They're the only amendments that have been offered up to us, and they would take it back to the way the bill was originally introduced, which is to require a vote of the people of Wood Village alone. The other surrounding cities would be left out of it. Do I hear a motion on the A-12 amendments? Representative Kopp.
Chair McPherson, committee, I make a motion to put the dash A-12s into Senate Bill 1042.
Representative Comp moves the dash A-12 amendments into Senate Bill 1042. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a no vote because I'm going to explain my vote here real quick, that I'm not so sure I wouldn't like to have people in the state of Oregon on a local basis make decisions as to whether they should have a casino or not in their backyard. I'd like them to have that ability to make that decision. But this doesn't do that. It only does it for private casinos. So I'm going to be a no vote. I'm glad we got it down to one city. And I may change my vote on the House floor, though.
Any further discussion? If there's no further discussion, then we'll take a roll call vote on the motion from Representative Comp to move the A-12 amendments into Senate Bill 1042.
Representative Alderminci.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Comp.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Oh, Mr. Sunday.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Courtesy, yes.
Chairman
Person. Aye. A12 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to change my vote on the A12 amendments.
Okay. Very good.
We have from no to aye.
Okay. We have a motion carries moving the A12 amendments into Senate Bill 1042. Do we hear a motion on the main bill?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1042 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Comp moves Senate Bill 1042 as amended by the A12 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to give a courtesy yes vote on this. I have a lot of concerns about it for various reasons, many of which have been discussed. There's already an existing structure of land use laws that I think apply. I may change my vote on the floor. I don't know. I'll be giving it a lot of thought. I also have a concern about the incorporated city. My district, for example, is a patchwork of incorporated city and unincorporated county. And so if this bill applies statewide, which it does, and somebody wants to put a casino in, for example, Beaverton, I couldn't vote on it because even if it was in my backyard, because I live in an unincorporated portion of the county. So that's another concern I have, but I will give it a courtesy yes.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Same comments. I'm disappointed in the League of Oregon Cities for not standing stronger against this. I do think it's taking away local control. I understand and I certainly agree that if I lived in a neighborhood, I'd want to have a say-so in whether a casino came into that neighborhood, but I think this is the wrong way to go about it. I don't think the state should be involved in it. I think the local mayors and the leaders could do that. I'll be giving it a courtesy yes for the people of Wood Village.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there is plenty that has been said and with which I agree in regard to the conflict with current land use regulations and applicable city, county, and state land use and building requirements. I give a courtesy yes, may reserve the right to vote no on the floor. My courtesy is extended to Senator Monis Anderson, Representatives Minnis and Lim in this regard.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Krieger.
Well, I've been pretty quiet today.
Uncharacteristically so, Representative.
We're all conflicted, every one of us. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give a courtesy vote. And again, like everyone has said, hey, I may change my mind before it gets to the floor. But this has been probably one of the more difficult issues we've looked at, I think, this session. And I've seen a little wrinkles on your brow a few times.
Yeah,
that,
you know, so
that's where I am.
Okay. Just briefly, I'm a courtesy yes. And I would love to see what the vote would be if this was a secret ballot.
Boy.
True. Chair will chime in as well on the sort of the policy issue. If this, as a general matter, requiring statutorily a vote how a local jurisdiction will make its local land use decisions would be troublesome to me because that's for the local jurisdiction to decide how it's going to be answerable to its own residents. What makes me comfortable with that moving this bill is that we're dealing with a project where the siting is being done by all the people of Oregon. All the people of Oregon are being asked to say it's going to be in Wood Village, and that we wouldn't pass a bill that says, let the people of Wood Village also decide, seems to me inappropriate. If we're going to have an initiative going out to the people, that will, and if that doesn't pass, all this is moot, telling them that that Wood Village, you're going to have a casino there, then I think having the people of Wood Village being able to weigh in on that decision is appropriate. So I support the bill as well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
After this, the pig bill will be easy.
If there's no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
No.
Representative
Wallace.
Aye.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnant. Aye. Chair McPherson. Aye. Senate Bill 248 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. And Representative Comp, would you be willing to come
I would be pleased.
Thank you very much. Close the work session on Senate Bill 248. We're now going to move to a much easier bill. I think we need an easy one. We're going to skip over 573 for the moment. To come back to it later and open a work session on Senate Bill 629.
It's just
a
issue.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 629A relates to money judgments against incarcerated persons. ORS 137.183 provides that money judgments and criminal actions accrue interest at the rate of 12.5% annually for the first 5 years from the date the judgment is entered, and then at a 4% rate for each subsequent year. It's presently irrelevant whether a defendant is sentenced to prison. The same rules apply. Interest begins to accumulate right away. Senate Bill 629A amends ORS 137.183 to provide that interest does not accrue on any money judgment while the defendant is incarcerated. Once a defendant is released, interest would then begin to accrue on the first day of the second full calendar month following sentencing, and it would be at the flat statutory rate of 9%. Senate Bill 629A applies only to judgments entered after July 1, 2007, which is also the effective date of this act. When we heard testimony on this previously, there was talk about reconciling this bill with House Bill 2311A, which was over in the Senate, and that bill stated that criminal judgments bear interest only for 20 years after a judgment is entered. There was an amendment that was adopted to House Bill 2311A that reconciles the bills in effect, and so there's no longer an issue. I can give more explanation if necessary, but in any event, 2311A was amended in an appropriate fashion, and so if this one could go forward.
And as you may recall, committee, we had held up action on this bill only because we wanted to make sure that 2311 got amended so that we wouldn't have that quirk where a person who was serving a long sentence would have their interest running only for the remainder after their sentence was served of the first 20 years. They will certainly, their interest will accrue for 20 years.
Just a quick question, Council. Was it the A4 amendment to 2311 that I have in my bill file?
That's correct.
That was the one that was adopted.
That's correct.
And because that was adopted in the other bill, there's no need to amend 629 to get the right result.
Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 629 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 629 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I think I'd like to put on the record I think this was worked, and I think we also, the committee heard that the victims understand that they're not losing money, they're actually gaining money, because people were asking me, why are you voting to do this? And that's the Crime Victims United or the task force, it's going to guarantee them a better chance of getting some restitution funds than what the current system. So I think that's important to put on the record.
Very good. Any further discussion? Hearing none, then we have a motion to move Senate Bill 629A to the floor of the due pass recommendation. The clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonaminci.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Ford.
Aye.
Representative Cox?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. Senate Bill 629A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Anybody particularly would like to carry that bill? Representative Flores, thank you very much. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 629 and open a work session on Senate Bill 573A. Council Stanford.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 573A relates to the pedestrian crosswalk bill. Present ORS 811.028 creates a Class B traffic violation for drivers who fail to stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian. Presently, the offense covers failing to stop and remain stopped for pedestrians who are element one, there are two ways, proceeding in accordance with a traffic control device, or crossing a roadway in a crosswalk. And then element two, the pedestrian enters into a lane that the driver is in, a lane adjacent to the lane the driver is in, a lane into which the driver is turning, a lane adjacent into the lane into which a driver is turning, or a location less than 6 feet from the lane into which a driver is turning. Senate Bill 573A adds an additional means for how a driver could violate the statute of failure to stop and remain stopped. And that is if the driver does not stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian when the pedestrian is waiting on the curb or shoulder of the highway at a crosswalk and raising a hand and arm toward oncoming traffic. The primary motivation behind this change is that technically under present law, a pedestrian must actually take a step into the street in order to legally force vehicles to stop. Senate Bill 573A is a means to attempt to allow the pedestrian to actually stop traffic legally while remaining safely on the curb. There is an amendment, the A4 amendment. It is for the committee's consideration, and what it does is it adds language, whereas it presently says the driver of a vehicle commits the offense of failure to stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian if the driver does not stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian, blah, blah, blah. This adds the words, if it is reasonably possible for the driver to safely stop the vehicle and the driver does not stop and remain stopped. So it adds the element of it must be reasonably possible for the driver to safely stop.
Representative Krieger. I had some concerns, Mr. Chair, about this and expressed them before, but even with the vulnerable driver bill we had and this one and several others, we're putting all the burden on the vehicle because the vehicle is a thing that can cause so much physical harm to people on skateboards, pedestrians and that type of thing. But none of the legislation reaches educating in any way pedestrians, bike riders, how they can go about skateboarders. We had one of them the other day, my wife and I. How they can take part and be presence with vehicles and make themselves more or less vulnerable. And I mentioned to one of the members, I can't remember who it was, but we're going down the street, Corey and I, leaving the Capitol, and this kid is running along the sidewalk with his skateboard. We stop at the stop sign. He puts his board down. It goes across through that intersection in the crosswalk. I don't know, 10 miles an hour? I mean, he's going. There's no way he could stop. There's no any way that anyone could see him. And unless we start making pedestrians and non-vehicle users more aware of the danger that they create, there's going to continue to be more hazards. I don't see anyone working towards doing that, and I won't be in favor of the bill as it's written. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I voted for the bicycle bill, but to Representative Reed, and I've talked to Representative Buckley about this, I'll be a no vote. I think my reason is I think there's the state's too diverse to try to put this into place. I think it needs it'd be like a city ordinance. Representative Buckley informed me that it's working in Ashland, and that's good. I think that's where it should be. I just think that what we're trying to do here, although it has good intention, just doesn't apply as a statewide bill. So I'll be a no.
Okay.
Question.
Representative Bonamici.
Council, does the dash A4 amendment take out the hand signal part of the bill? I can't figure out where this goes.
Representative Bonamici, no. It does not. What it would do, it goes, I'm looking at the A engrossed Senate Bill 573, and I think there's actually a technical error in the amendment itself. But the raising a hand and arm toward oncoming traffic, that is the end of line 23 and the start of line 24, would stay in. What the amendment does is it adds after if on line 22, where right now it reads, the driver of a vehicle commits the offense of failure to stop and remain stopped for a pedestrian if the amendment would insert, it is reasonably possible for the driver to safely stop the vehicle and the driver, and then they should have eliminated the driver.
Last thing, yeah. The driver in the amendment just shouldn't be there because the right. Driver's already in the text.
Right.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm gratified to know that the city of Ashland has a city ordinance in this regard, because my comment was going to be, I think this definitely, if there is anything in this session that should be a likely candidate for either a pilot project, this would be the type of bill that should be, to see what the results are. As overall statewide policy in every city and locality, I do not think I cannot support this bill.
Representative Bonamici.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've thought about this a lot and have some concerns about it. I understand Representative Buckley tried this in Ashland and it works, but I don't think there's anything in the law currently that prohibits a pedestrian from waving a hand or putting an arm up if that pedestrian wants to enter the street as a signal to the cars that are coming. My concern about putting that into law is that I don't want drivers to think, I didn't realize the person was going to cross the street. I didn't realize that pedestrian was going to step into the street because the pedestrian didn't have his or her arm up. So that's my concern about it, and I'm going to be a no.
Well, committee, I'm sensing there's not sufficient support. We haven't heard from everybody, but I don't know that we need to. There's not sufficient support to move this bill forward. And unless somebody speaks up on its behalf, Representative Kump.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I wanted to just make a comment, and I understand where people are thinking, but I live in a community of 20,000 people. The amount of lighted signal crosswalks is extremely limited. If I didn't count them ahead of time, but I think there's less than 10. And frequently, well, what our city has done in Woodburn is work really hard to make sure that people know that our streets are safe. 15 years ago, an average person would not walk down the street because they're afraid of gang activity. We have evolved into a community of wide diversity and caring people and lots of elderly people that love to walk. I see this as an advantage for them, and if we don't move the bill, I just think that there are considerations we need to look at when we're thinking about these types of things.
I appreciate those comments, Representative Kump, and just so the proponents of the bill understand, I would support the bill as well, but I sense that we're in a minority within the committee. So I'm going to, unless somebody else has other comments to make, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 573 and open work session on Senate Bill 694A.
We have time to do this.
Well, I wanted to. Depends on how much time you think people will. This will take. I was hoping this could be done quickly, and because I also wanted to get photos of the committee here before we went to the floor. And do people have a lot of that we want to talk about?
Forgot my pig mask.
Or we could roll this one over actually until the 2:30 meeting. If you prefer to do it then.
I'm willing to go.
Let's go.
Let's go. Okay. We are in work session on Senate Bill 694, and there is an amendment to present on the pregnant bill, the pig bill.
Chairman McPherson, I can summarize the bill, but I don't really think I need to.
Okay, yeah, don't just describe the amendment.
It's the pig bill, and the amendment says it's not a Class A misdemeanor any longer; it's a Class A violation, and that is the A3 amendment.
So, counsel. What is the sanction for a Class A violation?
$720 max.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
I'm going to vote for the bill, but this is something that's not ever going to happen. How would you ever prove that the pig was confined in this position for 12 out of any 24 hours? We're not using this today, nor will we. We could pass a law, and I mentioned this earlier, that said it was illegal to canoe up over Multnomah Falls. That wouldn't change anything, and I don't think this really changes anything. The only thing I don't want to do, the set of precedents that all of a sudden we're going to start micromanaging all of the different ways in which livestock is held, dairies and that. You know, dairies, they have places where cows don't go out into pastures anymore. They're rotated through a system. You know, I start seeing any more of this come, I'm going to be a flat no on all of it. So,
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's probably time to do that, Representative Krieger. In this particular regard, however, looking at information from a pork producer here in Oregon, gas station stalls are not used by the hog industry in the state of Oregon. Reaffirmed by the fact from the Humane Society of the United States May 18th presentation that said there are 4,000 breeding pigs here in Oregon, yet it's estimated that most of the animals are not kept in gestation crates. This is not a problem. I think we should not be legislating this. By 2012, the practice will be done by virtue of the movement within the industry itself. I will be a no on the bill.
Okay.
Just a comment, Chair and Committee. The one testimony we had from an Oregon pig farmer about pigs and crates and that not happening in Oregon, but part of his testimony, and I was listening very carefully, was saying, he was quasi saying that if that happened, it really wasn't that big of a deal. And because people are using common sense, but my only comment is somebody that's had four children, and I didn't weigh 700 pounds, which a sow can weigh an appreciable amount, particularly before she has her piglets, whatever they're called at this point in life. I would not want to be confined to a 2-foot anything if I was weighing 700 pounds.
You do that daily on the House floor.
Pardon me? Go ahead.
Sit on that chair on the House floor.
Well, I'll tell you.
Any further comments or discussion on Senate Bill 654?
I guess I have to make a comment.
Thank
you,
okay,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisniewski.
You know, I think we all care about animals and abuse and things like that, but I think this is really going too far into how you manage your produce, and there's no one that respects and understands the value of protecting their livestock better than a farmer. I'll be a no vote on this. But.
Okay. Any further discussion?
I'll just say that I think the amendment saves the day on this one. It certainly shouldn't be a crime.
Yeah. Right.
And I'll be a yes vote. So we have an amendment?
Yeah, do we have a motion on the A3 amendments?
Mr. Chair, I move the A3s be moved into Senate Bill 694.
Representative Barker moves the A3 amendments into Senate Bill 694. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Then the A3 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 694 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 694 as amended by the A3 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Flores.
No.
Representative Call.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Oink.
Not
We'll take that as a yes.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
I think I was told I have to do sui or something. That's
no.
That's two.
Okay.
No.
A no for Representative Wisnett. Aye. Senate Bill 694 moves to the floor with a due pass. Representative Kump, you had made some good comments there. Do
well,
you mind?
I would love to carry it, and my only caution is that the ultimate penance in our household was if we screwed up at school. We had to clean the pig pen on Saturday, and
right.
So long as I don't have to clean the pig pen, I would love to carry it.
Very good. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 694. Remainder of our agenda, which is continuation of the work session on Senate Bill 248A and the work session on Senate Bill 438A, is rolled over until we reconvene at 2:30 this afternoon. So we are now in recess, not adjourned, but in recess until.
Mr. Chair, do you know if we have acceptable on?
We have an amendment, and I need to discuss that with council and with the stakeholders to see whether it's acceptable.
248
and 248.
Okay, we are in recess.